From the studios of EWTN, this is Open Line with today's host, Father Mitch Pacwa. In North America, call toll-free 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985 or send an email to openline@ewtn.com.
Good afternoon. This is Father Mitch Pacwa in one more episode of Pacwa Unleashed. Jack is not here. I have no idea where he is or what he's doing. That is his wife's job, not mine. So I am over here having my own good time and being with y'all. So again, the phone number here is 833-288-EWTN. We have some open lines here, or if you don't know your letters of your alphabet, then it's just 833-288-3986, and we'll get you here online. If you are outside North America, you can still call in, but not with that number. It won't work. So you have to call country code 1, area code 205-271-2985. And that'll get you in here. We'll be happy to talk to you about your questions. I, as usual, will start off with some emails. And the first email is from Frank. He says, in Luke chapter 2, verse 30, Simeon recognizes Jesus as the Messiah and exclaimed, my eyes have seen your salvation. In Matthew 16, verse 16, Simon, son of Jonah, also known as Simon Peter, said, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. In each case, there is a recognition of the Savior. Is there any significance to the similarity of the names Simeon and Simon regarding these revelation events? Thank you, Frank. Well, first of all, Frank, it's not only that they're similar. Remember, when you are transliterating from one language to another, you do your best to transliterate. So sometimes you just go by how a word sounds when you don't have certain letters. In fact, the names are actually totally the same. In Hebrew, the name would be Shimon. Shimon would mean the one who listens. It's from Shema to listen. And both of them would mean the same. It's just that St. Luke transliterated a little bit differently than St. Matthew. Secondly, but otherwise, same word, from the same root. Secondly, it turns out that the name Shimon or Simon is the most popular name for Jewish boys in the first century AD. How do we know that? We didn't take a survey, except of graves. From the graves and the frequency of the name Shimon, we know that that was the most popular name among Jews. That's what's going on. Now, you could perhaps read a certain type of significance by thinking that since the name means one who listens, that they are listening to God. That'd be possible. But other than that, it's just that this was a very popular name. All right. Now, we have another question. And this is, hello, Father Mitch. If a priest leaves the ministry and marries, is it possible under any circumstances that Rome would grant a dispensation for holy orders? Not as while you're still married. That wouldn't be so. But I have known of a dispensation. In the case of one man who that I knew and talked to, there's probably others like him, he married, left the priesthood and married, had a wonderful long marriage. His wife died, and then he was, you know, through practice, you know, through you know, careful work with the local bishop and such, he was admitted back to the priesthood. So that has happened. I knew such a person, and I'm sure there are other cases of that. Now, the only other case would be if somebody left the Protestant ministry, then they might be ordained a priest. And also, someone who leaves, is Orthodox and is a married priest and becomes a Catholic would be a married priest in the equivalent or corresponding Eastern Catholic Church. That certainly happens. So that's, and then of course in the Eastern churches, they do have a married clergy, and we're seeing that since permission was given for the Eastern churches to have married clergy here in the United States and in the West, there are a number of members of the Eastern Church who are married and then become priests later. Okay. And, this is an interesting, similar question from Dan. Is there any possible way that a man can leave the priesthood and be married and still be okay with his state of grace? Yeah, he can, you know, certainly be in the state of grace. And for one thing, if he gets a dispensation through the proper channels, and then is, you know, after he gets a dispensation, he marries, then he's still within the state of grace, okay? And then the question is, since marriage is forever, yet the church allows for annulment in certain cases, is there any extreme situation where the ordination can be found invalid by Rome? First of all, marriage is not forever. Marriage is until death do you part. So marriage lasts as long as one, at least one of the spouses is alive. If the other one dies, then the marriage is over because the person has died. So it's only until death do you part. But you can have an annulment if it was shown to be invalid. Now, if an ordination is shown to be invalid, then of course the priest would be in a he would not be ordained. There was a case that I heard of where a bishop toward the end of his life finally admitted to a very, very grave sin on his part. That when he did not like Jesuits, so when he ordained Jesuits, he did not have the intention to ordain. And this is something that made all of those ordinations invalid. If the bishop does not have the intention of passing on the priesthood, then the ordination is invalid. Now, for a bishop to do such a thing is a very grave sin on his part. He's lying to not only to the ordinandi, but to the people of God that this guy is validly ordained. And I hope he repented because he admitted this on his deathbed. Hope he was sorry, or else he would be. But then it would be invalid. And there might be some other cases for invalidity. And then if that can be shown, then he's not a priest. That's what invalidity of the priesthood can be. Can the Holy Father issue such a decision? He can, but there would have to be an examination of the case for invalidity of ordination that would mean that there was reason, the Pope can't just arbitrarily declare that as a reason for invalidity, that something was missing. And one is, I have known four instances where priests left the priesthood for a relationship, and I'm concerned for those involved. Well, if they legitimately left the priesthood, they would be okay. But if they did not leave through the proper channels, then they are what's called a sacerdos fugitivus, a fugitive priest, and they would have certain things that'd be a sinful situation. So you should be worried about them. Try to make sure that you help them get right with God. All right. We will be back in a couple minutes with your phone calls, so please stay with us.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. If you have a question, call 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. Or send us an email to openline@ewtn.com.
All right, we're waiting for, we have some more, a couple more call lines open. I just want to also mention something about Wings. Wings is an EWTN weekly e-newsletter. I can find out about what's happening on EWTN radio and TV shows, find out what's at EWTN Religious Catalog and lots more. You can just sign up for Wings by going to EWTN.com and click subscribe. It's easy and the price is right. It's free. All right, let us now go over to Levi, who is in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Levi, what can we do for you?
Hi, Father. I don't know if this is the correct way to say it, but peace be with you.
That's a good way to say it. I'll take that, and peace be back with you, too. What's up?
I didn't know if that was right because, well, you know, you're clergy, but...
Oh, no, that's good. Oh, I need peace, too. That's for sure.
Okay. Well, Father, I have a question that's more of a pastoral sense.
Sure, sure.
So, I kind of watched a movie like a week or so ago, mm-hmm. or like a month or so ago, and it kind of made me realize that I was just kind of going through a bit of a rough patch, and, mm-hmm. you know, I just, sometimes when I try to, like, read the Bible, you know, you see in John, Jesus tells the apostles, you know, peace I leave with you, my peace I give you.
Mm-hmm.
You see when St. Paul talks about the way of love in 1 Corinthians, he says, mm-hmm. you know, love bears all things, endures all things, and hopes all things.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, how exactly are we, you know, supposed to live that out in times of, you know, struggle?
Mm-hmm. You know, you don't need to go into the details, but what kind of struggle? Is it a struggle of sickness or pain, or is it an emotional struggle or moral struggle or job struggle? That can make a difference. And you may not want to talk about what it is at this point, but pay attention to what it is you are struggling with. That's the first start. And listen to you know, when you have a struggle, I I'm not sure what kind you're dealing with, but when you have a struggle, it normally means that two different realities, two different things are pulling at you one way or the other. Would that be correct?
I would say so, yes.
Yeah, that's kind of normal, a struggle. And, you know, you feel, depending on the kind of struggle it is, you feel the attraction of both of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what you have to do at that point is pay close attention to what is pulling you one way, what is pulling you the other way? Secondly, why would you be interested in the pull in the direction, I'm just using this arbitrarily, but say the direction that goes to your left versus the pull that goes to your right, or however that. Again, I like to think of this in terms of a spectrum, and there are two ends to every spectrum. Why are you pulled to one end of the spectrum, and why are you also pulled or attracted to the other end of it? What is the value that is at stake on each side? Because they both have a certain attraction, don't they?
Yes.
And as you're dealing with that, you have to say, wait a second. Which one of these pulls, while it looks attractive, if I move toward the one side, do I find myself more at peace? Or if I go to the other side, am I more at peace? What is that attraction and pull? And where do I start to find that one will, part of it is to find where there's more peace and growing in love. And sometimes the other pole that pulls you is making you unloving, unpeaceful, especially if it's something that is bad for you, but still has an attraction. And you have to ask, where is that coming from on each side? Another part of that is not only emotional, but also thinking through where this would lead. If I follow this attraction, what are the moral ideas? See, morality is not about what you feel. Morality is thinking about right and wrong. And what that means is you think about, is this helping me accomplish the goal of my life? Or is it hindering me from getting the goal of my life? So, for instance, yeah, I take it that you have a stomach, right?
Yeah.
And you fill it on a regular basis, two or three times a day, right?
Yeah.
When you eat, you can tell some things make you feel better and help build your health. And other things can harm or even destroy your health. So as much as you've heard that eating ground glass might be good for you, which I hope you've never heard that because it's not true. But if you ate ground glass, that would destroy your stomach, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So you don't eat ground glass. That would be immoral. And it would also be immoral to drink too much alcohol and get drunk. It destroys brain cells. It makes a mess of your life and gives bad headaches. So, you have to learn to think through the moral side of it. That's what we do with these struggles. And here's the good news about those struggles. A, they're inevitable, but this is precisely where we mature and become men or become women if we're female. This is where our authentic maturity comes from. Taking these struggles on, thinking through the moral questions, but also having the inner will to do what is right because it is right and not do wrong because it is simply wrong. That is where maturity comes from. Does that get at some of the issues?
I just have kind of one small little addendum. What if it seems that we can't find peace?
If you can't find the peace, this is something that you then have to ask why. It's no giving up. It's asking, why don't I? Now, I'm not finding peace in this. Why am I not? And I can't say for everybody else, but Levi, one of the things that I've noticed in my own life is that at those times when I did not find peace with something, it's because I was still self-blinded to some aspect of my own self-will or selfishness that I didn't see, and I had to confront who I am even more honestly. I've learned over the years that when I am not in a state of peace, it's because I have to confront another element that I don't see yet, or I'm blind to, or I'm willfully blind to my correction. That's something. Do you have somebody out there that you can talk to?
I mean, I have friends, yeah.
Find someone, preferably perhaps someone who's maybe a little more mature in spiritual life and or psychology. And I'm not saying a psychologist or something, but somebody who just has a little bit more wisdom and life experience, and try to talk to them honestly about what's going on. See if maybe they can help you get a perspective on something you might not yet see. That's something I would do. Get to talk to someone you trust and who has what is good for you in mind, and not about themselves, but they really care about you and presumably our Lord. Get to talk to somebody about that's going to be necessary, I think. Because it sounds like it's something, you know, profound that you're dealing with and really needs to be addressed. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Thank you, Father.
You're welcome, Levi. You're welcome. All right, let us now go over to Susan in Melbourne, Florida. Susan?
Yes.
There you are. How are you? What can we do for you?
I was at a mass last Saturday, which was the first Saturday, with some friends of mine. It's a group where I am aspiring to become a member.
Uh-huh.
And so we're all at mass together.
Sure.
And recently at this church, they have started having a healing mass, you know, on every first Saturday.
Okay.
And I'm observing that every single person goes up.
Huh.
And my question is, am I looking prideful if I don't?
No.
I mean, I care how I look in front of these people, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, normally, but I do care.
Okay. Here's the question. Are you ill?
Well, I'm 73 years old, and I have a few chronic conditions.
Well, yeah. Well, yeah, you youngsters, you're still younger than I. But yeah, you youngsters sometimes get those aches and pains too. But yeah, if you're ill, there's no problem getting anointed. But if you're not, don't feel a need to do so. You know, usually the illness, if it's serious enough to call a doctor, then get anointed. All right, got to take a break. We'll be back in a couple minutes.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Welcome back. This is Father Mitch Pacwa on another episode of Pacwa Unleashed. Jack's not here. Still don't know where he is. None of my business. So just let him be. But I'm here, and we are about to speak to Bonnie, who's in the great city of St. Louis, Missouri. Bonnie, what can we do for you? Bonnie?
Yes, hi.
There you are.
Father Pacwa.
Hi.
Yeah. I want to check if a certain yoga practice is acceptable for Catholics as a health practice,
yeah,
or is it not advisable because it would be getting into Buddhism?
Uh-huh.
And specifically, one of my adult children wants to help me with my neurologic disorder.
Okay.
He has sent me some tuning forks to listen to. Are you familiar with that?
I used tuning forks in the past to tune musical instruments, but I am not familiar with tuning fork healing.
It's supposedly the vibrations.
Yeah, I know. I know. I figured it was the vibrations. That's usually what they go for, is vibrations. Here's the thing I would require from your child. Where are the double-blind studies showing that tuning forks help healing with this kind of, the kind of disorder that you have?
Okay.
You know, where, and because, said, well, I knew this lady. You don't go by, I knew this guy or this lady that they did, and they were jumping around. That is anecdotal evidence. And you can't use anecdotes as a basis for a claim that this works. How, in other words, you are asking your child, as wonderful as your child may be, to give you evidence that this is not snake oil. And that requires double-blind studies. When we get medicine, we want double-blind studies. I was part of a double-blind study for rheumatoid arthritis treatment called Humira. I was actually the first one in the study. There was somebody in the study before me who dropped out, so I became number one in the study. And it worked. But they didn't tell me I was getting the medicine. They didn't tell the people who were getting a placebo they were getting a placebo. We didn't know. And I reported right away that I felt better. But then they studied it for 10 years to make sure that it worked. So I did the double blind and then the open study. This is what medicine does. And you are dealing with a medical situation. Here's where the problem comes in, Bonnie. When somebody uses some technique that has not been studied and doesn't have the double-blind evidence to verify it, then they say, well, maybe you didn't have quite the right oil attitude or whatever. You need to, and this becomes a way that when it doesn't work, they use it to say, well, let's try this now. Let's do this yoga practice. Let's try this Buddhist practice. Let's do this. And it becomes a way to hook people into other things that also do not work. You see what I'm saying there?
Yes.
One of my daddy's jobs was as a used car salesman. And so I am alert to shills. You know, the used car dealers used to say, we have this 2015 Maverick clean on the job for $500 to the first one that comes. You know who the first one always was? The mechanic at the garage. He bought it every week. And then they put it back out for sale again. And that's a shill. It's to get you to come into the lot to try to get there before the chief mechanic buys it. But it's not for sale. He sells it back to the dealer. So that's what I'm concerned, that this is a shill for something else. Demand to see where you can find it. Maybe they don't have the copy of double-blind studies, if they exist, which I doubt. But say, where can I look that up? I want to see the studies. That's what medicine requires, Bonnie. And your health is too important to leave to some shill. Does that make sense?
I think it is getting into Buddhism because
yep.
the frequency of one of these is Om.
They call
the perfect frequency in the universe or something.
As the kid said in Going My Way, I'm going to drop you like a hot potato. That's what I would do with this. I don't think it's going to work. Talk to your own doctor, too, about it, okay?
So much, Father.
You're so welcome, Bonnie. God bless you. Let's go to Kelly in the great state of Indiana. Kelly, what can we do for you?
Yes, Father Mitch, hello. My question is, we know that the Blessed Mother was with the Apostle John at the foot of the cross with Jesus. And I'm wondering why the Romans would have allowed that.
Kelly, let me ask you this. Have you ever seen an old John Wayne or any of those old Westerns?
Oh, yeah.
And ever see, yeah, I think we got some enthusiasm here. And ever see when they had a hanging?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And do they do it behind walls or do they do it in the public street?
Right in the public street.
And why do they do that?
Wow.
Well, I don't know if you like Toby Keith, but he and I forget the other guy's name did a song called Beer for My Horses. Willie Nelson. And one of Willie Nelson's line in that song is, they call a long rope in Texas for a high tree, hang them up in, for all the people to see. And the idea is that you want people to see this so they don't make the same mistake. Public executions were part of the deterrence. And that's why the Romans didn't mind who was there. Does that make sense now?
Yes, it does.
All right. Well, that was easy. Let's now go over to Troy, who is in Norman, Oklahoma. What's up, Troy?
I've only been a Catholic for about a year and a half.
Oh, well,
and
welcome.
I come from a very anti-Catholic background religiously.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And I have embraced Catholic doctrine, including the doctrines about Mary.
Mm-hmm.
And I see the truth of them, but I'm having trouble connecting to Mary.
Yeah, yeah.
I pray to her, and I just, there's something missing, and sure. I'm just not sure how to break through my background and
sure.
be able to embrace her with my heart as well as my head. I wondered if you had any thoughts.
Yes, I do. Troy, have you ever seen the movie, the one It's the Passion of the Christ. That's it. The Passion
yes,
of the
I
Christ.
Have.
And go to the scene where Jesus is carrying his cross through the streets of Jerusalem, and he sees his mother. And then look at what Gibson did. As a matter of fact, they're singing a hymn in Arabic, and the woman singing it is a Lebanese Christian named Fairuz. You can get the song online. It's all over the online. It's one of the most. It's called Ya'um. Ana al-Um al-Hazina. One of my absolute favorite hymns. I just love that hymn. And what it means in Arabic is, I am the sorrowful or grieving mother. And as he sings that, and think of the scenes that come to Christ's mind as he passes his mother. And one of the ways to help enter into, a love of her is to try to look at Christ through her eyes. If, you know, in the way a mom would look at a child who is suffering. A mom who sees this and the kind of love that she has for a child that is suffering so much. That movie really captured, you know, some of the way her tenderness towards Christ as his mom came across, and it got, you know, onto film in a fantastic way. Think, and then just use the passage, say in John 19 or one of the other passages of Scripture, where you try to look at Christ through her eyes. You can do this at the birth of Christ, at the Annunciation, at the finding in the temple. There are some, but try to think about imaginatively thinking, what would the Blessed Mother be thinking as she looks at Christ? That would be a helpful way, I think, to understand why the devotion to her is so powerful. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And that's definitely something that I'll go back and rewatch that scene.
Yes.
Or rewatch the movie.
You can see it on air, online, I mean. Yeah, there, a lot of people have put that hymn, Aneluma Hazina, online with that scene. And it's just so moving. Again, it's one of my favorite hymns. You know, we've seen that at my parish at Holy Week. So I just love that. So that'd be a good way to get started, okay?
Are there any devotional books or resources
Yes.
you would recommend?
Yes. One of the things that I found helpful many years ago, and still I do it a little bit differently, but that was a great start for me. There's a book called A Scriptural Rosary. It gives one verse of the Bible for each Hail Mary for every decade of the Rosary. And that also is a good way to get at what I'm talking about. Marian devotion should be nurtured with a deeper and deeper scriptural source. We can understand her much better as we enter into the Word of God in relationship with her. That would be something I would recommend. Okay? And it's just
All
a little
right,
booklet. I know EWTN Religious Catalog has it. Lots of Catholic bookstores have it. Certainly Amazon. It's just called A Scriptural Rosary. It's a small little book. You can put it in your pocket. And I have found it very, very helpful. All right?
All right. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Call back and let us know how some of that works for you. All right, now I just have to make one announcement, a couple announcements here. First of all, this is the one-year anniversary of Beacon of Truth with my friend and former student, Deacon Harold Burke Sivers. Oh, these kids grow up so fast. But he's coming up with his one-year anniversary, and to celebrate, he is going to especially do some reflection on Psalm 150, a great psalm itself, and on the soulful psalms. What is he going to be doing this with James Brown? No, he's going to be doing on soulful psalms as he celebrates his one-year anniversary. Tune into that. And then tonight, at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I'll be on EWTN with another good friend, but he's older, too old to be my student, and that's Danny Abramowitz, and he's bringing two of his buddies, Les Madier and Carl Credure, two South Louisiana Cajuns who do this wonderful work of from a prayer group, a men's prayer group they belong to. And they are making coffins for little children who die. great, great ministry that their prayer group does. So join us tonight for that. Until then, let us now go over to William, who is in Carbondale, Illinois. William, are you part of the university yourself?
Well, no. No, once I was. That was back way back in time, going to 81, when I found out it wasn't for me. I had to learn through other ways.
There you go.
Make up the deficit.
That's well, all right. You know, it's good to find that out and then learn those other ways. What have we got for you?
I have a question, and it deals with the nature of sin in my life, mm-hmm. and it deals with my own rebelliousness, I think, rebellious nature. And I'd like to know, the one that contends with the walk in the spiritual life and faith, and it's a source of much error and sin, too, as I see it.
Mm-hmm.
And I really need to know which is the best approach, or what would you suggest one of the better ways or a way that we could overcome?
Again, I'm not asking you about any specific sins. That's for your confessor to know. But let me ask you this. Against whom are you rebelling?
Well,
besides God, of course,
besides what I see in the media sometimes, and can't buy or don't, mistrust maybe, but it's more than that. It deals with, I think, addictive behavior pattern I've noticed in life. Trying to replace one with the other, but without relying, basically, I'm not relying on God,
Yes.
And the Lord.
Yes. Okay. So, you're attracted. The addictive behavior is attractive, right?
Well, yes, it is.
Yeah.
Hard to overcome, too.
Yeah, right, right. And so, at that point where you have something that is stronger than your will, I think it is. Are you familiar with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay. If you go online, you can find those 12 steps very easily, very easily. And they actually provide a very useful tool for overcoming, any and all addictive behaviors. The first step is what I think you're doing. You're admitting, I'm attracted to these, to whatever it is, and I would like to keep doing that. But but at the same time, I can tell that it's destructive, and I am too weak to stop. That seems to be the difficulty for you, right? Just feeling too.
Well, it has been. It has been before.
Yeah. And so at that point, the first step is admitting your powerlessness. I am too weak, and that's very important. And the second step is to come to a deeper understanding that God is more powerful than anything to which you would be addicted. Now, for many people, it's alcohol that will kill them, and or drugs that will also kill them. And some people are addicted to shopping, and that would bankrupt them and destroy relationships. And on and on. People get addicted to all kinds of things, food, sexuality, shopping, gambling, all kinds of things. And it's only when we realize how weak we are and how God, and make an act of faith. This is an act of faith. That God is stronger than that. The one who created everything is more powerful than any addiction I might feel. That's the second step. And then, after you feel that you know, trust in God and believe him, you have to ask him, help me to overcome this. And, you know, and just to go through the other steps of making a thorough moral inventory. How did you get into this? What started it? Understanding what I've done wrong. Making a good confession is the fifth step. And just going through these steps, the advantage of these steps is that they break it down into bite-sized pieces. That's what you have to do with this. Take it down one bite at a time, and don't try to stuff a steak down a baby's throat, but you take one small bite at a time of going through these steps. That's the key. Does that sound sensible to you?
I think that provides a good map to go by.
Let's try that. Download that offline, online, I should say, and see if you can start to make some progress in that. We'll do well. We'll keep you in our prayers, William, and everybody else who's dealing with such things. Let us now go over to John, who is also in the great city of St. Louis, Missouri. John, what can we do for you?
Hey, I got a probably a quick question.
The questions are quick. It's my answers that go on forever, but go ahead.
Well, you're my second favorite guy on EWTN.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
So, yeah, you can't beat old Dr. Anders. He's something else.
Oh, wait a minute. Let me see if I can beat him up and make me the number one.
Oh, my.
I don't think so. He's great. So what can we do for you?
So I'm going to be 70. Got three daughters, 9 grandkids. Everybody's on these journeys nowadays. Some of them are pretty Catholic. Others are somewhere in the middle, and some of them are just hanging out there. But
right.
Trying to be the grandfather that just sits back and kind of has some answers, because I go to Mass every chance I get. It's very important to me.
Good.
But some that I heard my favorite guy, Dr. Anders, bring up was that Mass obligation started in 1917. And I'm kind of old school, back before Vatican II, and it's like you go to Mass Sunday, either it's a mortal sin, and I mean, it was just sort of drilled into you. Now I go because I want to go.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what happened in 1917? Are you familiar with that at all?
Yes, that was the year that the Code of Canon Law was written down in an organized way. Now, the Sunday obligation, I always learned, was part of, you know, the commandments, and going to Mass on Sunday was part of it. But the Code of Canon Law was, they'd worked on it for a number of times. Prior to that, canon law had been this collection of lots and lots of books, and it wasn't so clearly organized. So in 1917, they organized the code. And then in 80-something, 84, whatever it was, they redid that code. So we have this the present Code of Canon Law. But the law to keep holy the Sabbath has been there. And then you see in the New Testament, as a matter of fact, if you're interested, there is a little, it's a apostolic letter by Pope St. John Paul. And the Latin title of it is Dies Domini. Now, in English, it's called Day of the Lord. But it's about the Sunday obligation. And in there, he does two things. One, he gives a history of the Sunday obligation, where that he gives the scriptural roots of it, how in the New Testament they were urged to go to Mass on the first day of the week, which is Sunday. And then how in the early fathers, and then he also gives a wonderful ideas on how to keep holy the Sabbath. So look up Dies Domini. You can get it from our website, EWTN.com. Go to the library, and you'll find it there, and that'd be a good source for you. Okay? All right. Let us, Lord, bless you all and keep you, cause his face to shine upon you, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And God willing, I'll be here next week with or without Jack.